Hello and welcome to this interview with Rupert Thompson about his first work of non-fiction, a memoir entitled This Party's Got to Stop. After spending 4 years working in advertising, Thompson, who was born in Eastbourne in 1955, embarked on a career as a novelist. Dreams of Leaving, his first novel, was published in 1987, and seven more highly acclaimed works of fiction have followed since, including The Book of Revelation, which was made into a film in 2006, and his most recent, Death of a Murderer, which was in part inspired by the death of Moore's murderer, Myra Hindley, and was shortlisted for the Costa Novel of the Year Award in 2008. Writing of Thompson's work in 2005, Andrew O'Hare said that his fans know when a new book appears that it won't fall readily into any known literary genre, but that it'll crackle along like a thriller, driven by sharp and luminous writing. In the end, there'll be something mysterious about it, as if its exciting events and characters are just a sort of smokescreen for something deeper and scarier still. Thompson's memoir, This Party's Got to Stop, will of course appeal to the writer's fans for the way in which it reveals the life of the man who created the fictions. But it also makes an excellent starting point for readers new to Thompson's work, for its immediacy, its lack of sentimentality, and yet its ability to explore most movingly what it means to be a son and a brother. Thompson lost both parents early. His mother died suddenly playing tennis one hot July day in 1964, when he was 8 years old. 20 years later, his father also died before Thompson had had the chance to say goodbye to him. It's these two deaths that impel Thompson to try to find out more about what kind of people his parents were, and to understand the impact that their deaths had on the person he himself became. But in addition to that, he also writes about the anarchic, reckless summer he and his two young brothers spent in the family home following their father's death. Like being children again, as he describes it, without the parents. A summer when furniture got smashed, beds got burnt, and the drugs were stashed alongside the baby food for his younger brother's daughter. When we met, I began, as the book does, with his mother's death. Writing of his impact, he says, "In a single afternoon, I stopped being myself and became somebody else altogether." I asked him if he could tell me more about registering that impact.
Jacqueline Rose says somewhere that what trauma does is freeze you precisely in time. And that certainly happened to me. I mean, there was a sense in which I was frozen by that sudden death. But I think even more than that, it derailed my life entirely. I mean, it moved me from being one kind of person to another kind of person overnight. And to all outward appearances, I mean, if I ask members of my family who were adults at that time, they tell me that I carried on pretty much the same. You know, I didn't seem any different, except for every now and then I would run into the house and call for my mother, you know, forgetting what had happened. But I think what I must have done, what my brain must have done, it must have taken the decision to completely repress all my memories of her, literally remove her from inside her own dresses, because I can remember the kind of dresses she wore, but I can't see her inside them. So the brain did this extraordinary, delicate job on me. And I'm talking about it like two different people, because that, in a way, is what it feels like. It's as if I divided into two, and one part of me thought, I've got to take care of this person, and this is the way we're going to do it. And now, who's to say whether that's the right decision or not? Anyway, that's what I'm living with. And so this extraordinary operation where all my memories of my mother were removed. So I have plenty of memories before I was eight, but she's not in any of them. And I mean, everyone has a sense, I think, of roads they could have taken in their life. You know, we all have these moments where we think, shall I go that way or this way? Or shall I go out with that person or not go out with that person? You know, there are thousands of those moments, and some of them bigger than others, and some of them absolutely fundamental. And this is what it was like for me. It was as if I had no choice but to take a certain road. And in the writing of this book, I was constantly thinking, what kind of person would I have been if she hadn't died? Would I have even written at all? You know, there's that big question. But also, I think when someone is removed at that kind of age in your life, what goes with them is a kind of confidence and stability. That all goes out of the window. It's as if you're being given a crash course in the fragility of things. And so confidence and stability has to be won back. You know, you have to fight and struggle for those things. And I would say in my case that it took at least 20 years, you know, to get some of that back. So yes, I say in the book, you know, that there I have moments where I feel as if there's another version of me walking alongside me. And of course, it's a slightly idealized version. It's also the version of me that's on the front of the book. When if you see the front of the book, you'll see an incredibly ebullient, full of life, kind of almost brash little boy, you know, 6-7 years old, running towards the camera. It's that boy I wonder about. You know, what would that boy have grown up to be? Because I'm not him.
The household that was left after your mother's death was your two brothers and your father and you. And your father was an invalid. And that sense of fragility comes out very strongly in worrying about him having lost one parent. You're really worried about the fragile parent remaining.
Well, that was the savage irony of the whole thing. I mean, the fact is, if anyone had been supposed to die, it was my father. He was the one who was ill. He was the invalid. You know, I never knew him as a healthy man. He'd been invalided out of the Second World, out of the Navy in the Second World War. He'd then spent 10 years in hospital, 4 major operations, and met my mother in the hospital because she was a nurse. So, you know, if Dad had died, of course it would have been a terrible shock, but a much more predictable one. As it was, we were left with the weaker of the two parents. And I guess this is another way in which my childhood changed so radically, because I was given a huge amount of responsibility at an early age. My brother said to me not so long ago that, you know, I had to become their mother, the mother of my two brothers, when my mother died. And I also, in some sense, had to look after my father. You know, I had to look out for him too. I sometimes think it is extraordinary that I've had any children at all, because I very much had to be a parent at the age of 8, from the age of 8 to at least the age of 15 or 16. That's what I was doing. And so my teenage years, you know, there was no room for rebellion or recklessness. You know, I had to be the solid one. I had to hold everything together. Which is why I think in the memoir, you know, some of our behavior, even though we're in our 20s, some of our behavior is quite adolescent. It's almost as if we're doing it then instead of before. So yes, the fragility of things, of life with my father was always keenly felt. And from the moment my mother died, pretty much, I had nightmares and I did a lot of sleepwalking.
You talk about your father's ambitions for you, and you describe yourself as being the host for his ambitions, which is quite a strong way of conveying that sense that he could only live through you, and you felt that weight upon you.
This was yet another way in which I was not allowed to be myself. You know, it wasn't only the responsibility that I had suddenly at the age of 8 and also the loss of confidence and stability. It was this idea that I had to live for my father. Who knows what he would have done if he'd been healthy, because he had all kinds of ambitions. I mean, everything from playing professional golf to sailing around the world. They tended to be kind of physical ambitions, although he was also a poet and a painter, and so he was very interested in the artistic world as well. But yes, he expected me to do things on his behalf, and I suppose I went along with it for a couple of different reasons. You know, I wanted him to be proud of me. I wanted to glow for him, I suppose. But also, I was keenly aware of his disability and of the things he couldn't do, of this world that was denied him. And I wanted him to get a glimpse of that, and I wanted to give him as much of that as I could. So, you know, I did take up golf at the age of 8 or 9, and, you know, I was out there every day playing with men of 60 or 70, all by myself. The irony being that my father was too sort of weak to actually get to the golf course and watch me. But when I got home, you know, he would all want to know all about it, and I'd have to report on, show him my card and the score and all that. And, you know, equally with university, I probably would have wanted to go to Oxbridge anyway. But, you know, it was definitely driven by my father. You know, he wanted to have gone to university, and he couldn't because of the war. It came at that very moment in his life when he was 17 or 18. So, yes, it's amazing I didn't sail around the world as well, really.
I suppose it seemed natural to you, but readers may be quite struck by the fact that after your father's death, all three brothers came back and lived in the house. I mean, did that seem a sort of natural reaction to you?
I say something about this in the book, actually, because at the time, I personally seemed to have no choice about it. I was living in West Berlin, and I got a new life, a completely different life. I had a girlfriend. We were living in Kreuzberg near the wall. I had friends. I was beginning to write. The last thing I really wanted was to go back to Eastbourne. In fact, I felt almost as if I'd only just left. And it takes a while at that age to create a completely new and independent life for yourself. And yet, perhaps because I was so aware of not having looked after my father in his last years, and because I was so aware of not having been there for him. He'd been alone, you know, for most of his last years. And also being aware of the fact that I'd kind of lied to him the last time I saw him, which was 3 months before his death. I'd gone down to visit him and only stayed a weekend. And then he'd said something to me like, can't you stay a bit longer? And I'd said, no, I'm flying back tomorrow. And I wasn't. I was going up to London to be with my friends. You know, so the guilt was... You know, it was capital G. And so I was in no doubt about the fact that I needed to go back and sort of address some of that and try and close the gap between myself and him now that he was dead, or try and close that gap. I was very surprised when both my brothers decided to do the same thing. I was rather looking forward to being there by myself, or if not by myself, with my next brother down, Robin, who was 3 years younger, because we knew each other very well. We saw each other a lot, and we shared exactly the same sense of humor and lifestyle, really. So when I first got back to Eastbourne, I was imagining I was going to be living there with Robin for a few months. You know, we'd be playing live music, we'd be playing music together, we'd be staying up late, we'd be drinking, there'd be parties, as well as all the things you normally have to do when someone dies. And I thought this could actually be quite a special summer. So much to my surprise, when I arrived back, when I flew back to Eastbourne, my youngest brother, Ralph, was already there, had already moved in. Not just Ralph either, but his wife, Vivian, and their little baby, 6-month-old baby. So suddenly there were five of us living in the house. This was a big shock, and it was also kind of a sense immediately that we're going to have to live in and do this whole thing in a completely different way than I imagined. I think as to why they came back as well, I think Robin would have come back for very much the same reasons as I did. Ralph, I'm not sure, because I've never really asked him that, but I think it was because he didn't want to feel left out. You know, he had this sense that he wanted to be part of that, even though he didn't really want to be with his brothers, even though he'd actually cut himself off from the family pretty much, even before my father died. If he hadn't done it, he would have been asking himself too many questions. You know, there would have been this blank that would never be filled in.
Can you describe what the atmosphere was like that summer in the house?
It's hard to describe, because often I felt as if it wasn't my house. It veered between moments of total abandon and then moments of sort of high tension, where you felt as if you could hardly move. This, for me, from my point of view, very much depended on my brother Ralph and his wife and baby, or the unit, as we came to call them, because they never did anything apart, you know. Very, very early on, we divided into two camps. There was myself and Robin who were doing the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We had drugs in the larder next to their tins of baby food. and we were playing music live late at night. God knows how the baby ever slept or how they ever slept. And you know, my brother Ralph was working. He was working in a bank and going to work every day. And we were, now I look back, extraordinarily inconsiderate, you know, of this young family with a baby. And yet at the time, we thought we were the normal ones. You know, we thought they were the strange ones. But if I tell you that, you know, almost the first thing that happened in the house was that I woke up one morning to the sound of hammering and looked around the corner, and there was this man I'd never seen before fitting an enormous chub lock, you know, the size of a fist, onto my brother Ralph's bedroom door, then that tells you pretty much all you need to know. It was two camps, and we tiptoed around each other. A lot of the time, if I walked downstairs in the morning and I saw through the crack in the kitchen door that Ralph's wife Vivian was already there with the baby, I'd often sort of back away and go back upstairs again and wait till they'd gone. We lived in that kind of way. It wasn't that big a house, but It was big enough not to always know where people were in it.
Tell me about the decision to write about these themes, because your career to date has been as a novelist. And I wondered at what stage you decided to write about your family. Had you already begun investigating it before you saw that it might be a book?
No, I mean, even at the time, I think I was aware that it was very unusual what we were doing. Not just the fact that we were all in our 20s, you know, we were quite young to lose both parents. And not just the fact that we all chose to live for 7 months in our dead parents' house, you know, and go through the whole process very slowly. But the way in which we did things, it was as if, I think I say it in the book somewhere, it was as if we were foreigners, you know, in another country, trying to learn the rituals and customs of that country. We tended to get things wrong. Almost everything we did, we got wrong. You know, every goodbye we attempted was kind of mismanaged. And yet that's very human, to get things wrong. You know, the Hollywood notion that we all cry over the coffin at the funeral is so wrong, isn't it? Because we don't tend, as human beings, we don't tend to react in the right way at the right moment. We might do it 2 months later when no one can see it, and then people can call you certain things because you haven't done it at the right moment. So as I say, you know, even at the time, I think it was a very vivid and extraordinary period in my life. And I always thought I would write about it, but the years went by and I didn't and I didn't and I didn't. For a couple of different reasons, I think. For a start, fiction was my dream. I mean, writing fiction, I thought, was where the excitement was. The idea that you could let your imagination loose and go anywhere. You know, this is what fiction allows you to do. That's what I wanted to explore. And secondly, there had been a rift with my brother Ralph after we left the house. We'd lived together for those awkward, anarchic 7 months together in the house. We'd managed to get through it somehow. But as soon as we left, I knew that I wasn't going to see Ralph and his wife again for quite some time. I mean, I didn't know it was going to be 24 years, but I knew it'd be a while. And I knew that it would be dangerous to write about him and his wife in that situation. Well, provocative, certainly, and maybe even dangerous, because after all, I did come down in the house sometimes for breakfast to find Ralph's wife, Vivian, sharpening her flick knife, you know, next to the cornflakes. So there was even a sense of physical threat. I felt that if I had written about them and exposed them in that way, they could come after me. So then I kind of, you know, by the time I got into the 90s, I was thinking, or even, you know, the early years of this decade, I was thinking, maybe it should be a secret book. You know, I should write it as a clandestine book alongside the novels, and it can be published after I'm dead. And that was a rather seductive notion, you know, a romantic notion as well. But I didn't put a word on paper. I didn't even write a word. And then there just came a moment, I don't know, 2005 or 6, where I thought it felt like the right time, suddenly. I still hadn't seen Ralph or Vivian, you know, so there was still that danger. And when I embarked on the book, I was very aware, when I embarked on the memoir, I was very aware that this was a double gamble, doing this. I mean, every book is a gamble, because you never know whether you're going to be able to carry it off or not. You know, generally you're attempting something that feels impossible, and you're trying to get as close. You're working with that notion of impossibility. This was a double gamble, because even if I managed to carry it off and finish the book and produce something I thought was good enough, would Ralph and Vivian allow me to publish it? You know, it might have been two and a half years' work for nothing. So I embarked on the book with a huge sense of trepidation, but felt that I had to give it a try.
What was the experience of actually sitting down to write it like, compared to writing fiction? Was it very different?
Oh, it was a nightmare. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. It was two things, again. James Salter says somewhere, and he wrote this wonderful memoir, Burning the Days, and somewhere in that memoir he says the experience of writing the book was, he was filled with something like self, it was self-wearying or something. It was, he almost talks about nausea and disgust and you know, these feelings about writing about yourself, the weariness you get from this self-revelation is what he was going on about. And I felt that almost every day in the early days when I went to work. I felt exhausted even before I sat down. And I felt a kind of sense of nausea that was almost physical, you know, just going back into all that material, going back into my own life and the lives of those who'd been close to me. Secondly, I felt straitjacketed, almost crippled by the fact that I was writing about what had really happened. Usually when I embark on a novel, I feel like someone driving along a motorway at night with no headlights on. I actually tried this once, and there's this amazing sense of motionlessness suddenly, and aloneness, and the feeling of being motionless and adrift. I mean, I only did it for a couple of seconds, but that's what starting a novel feels like. You don't know where you're going, and you don't know what the journey is going to involve, and you could probably crash as well a few times on the way. With the memoir, it wasn't like that. I knew exactly where I was going. You know, it was broad. I was driving in broad daylight. That made it incredibly difficult because I thought that it removed all the excitement of the unknown, which is what I associated with every day I'd ever spent writing, had that about it. And so it was only about a year or even 18 months into the writing of the book that I began to see the ways in which I might use my imagination. This was the problem. How am I going to free myself up within this straitjacket? You know, how am I going to use my imagination in relation to this material? And the first two drafts I wrote, you know, I'd simply wrote 1984 narrative, quite impressionistic, from the moment my father died until the moment we left the house. And, you know, that should have worked because that's a good beginning and an end, and all you have to do is, you know, then you put all the scenes in the middle and that should be a book. But it wasn't a book. It just wasn't a book. And it was only in the third draft where I looked at it more closely and I saw that there was something that shouldn't have been there. I suddenly noticed that it was there. There were five pages in the middle. It was an account of my one and only meeting with my Uncle Joe in Wolverhampton in 1986, so a couple of years after the years in Eastbourne. And my Uncle Joe had become a Muslim, so he wasn't Uncle Joe anymore. He was Abdul Rauf. And, you know, his brother, my mother's other brother, took me to see him. And I thought, what's that doing there? That shouldn't be there. That shouldn't be part of this book. And then I thought, no, wait a minute. That is the key to how I do this book, because what I saw, what it was doing there, was showing two other brothers and the relationship between two other brothers who had been driven apart by life, who were hardly on speaking terms. So I thought, that's the way forwards. If I can kind of create this, if I can go and meet other members of my family, I can create a kind of mosaic or jigsaw, and it'll allow all the pieces to work off each other, and I'll be able to create resonance and tension and the kind of flaccidness and fecklessness of the 1984 narrative. The weaknesses in that narrative will become strengths because they'll have something to play off. So it was only then, and it was a long, hard road to get to that point. But once I'd got to that point, I thought, oh, now at last, you know, I can see that I might have a book.
We began, Rupert, by talking about your mother's death and how she seemed to have vanished from inside her clothes and from your life. And I wondered, in conclusion, if I could ask you how you went about somehow bringing her back into focus, because that's one of the main threads of the book, is trying to find out who this woman was. Was there a point at which you felt enough of her presence was available to you at last?
I think I went as far as I could. I saw two different people, particularly in relation to my mother. I saw my Auntie Beth, who was my mother's cousin, almost exactly the same age, and who'd known her very well until she died. I went to talk to her, and I also found the woman who'd been playing tennis with my mother when she died, because my mother fell down dead on a tennis court in the middle of a game. I talked to those two women, and they told me a lot, but there's still someone else's memories, you know, and I, you know, if one of them said, as they did, she had this kind of very childish voice, even in her 20s and even in her early 30s, just before she died, she had this kind of naivety about her. She had a wonderful kind of untainted quality. Even if you have people telling you things like that, you still have to kind of buy into it. You know, it's not your version. It doesn't get you that much closer. I can describe my mother to myself, but I'm not feeling it. You know, I'm not really feeling it. And One of the questions I was asking myself in the memoir was, would I be able to write her back into existence? Would I be able to recreate her? I've done my best, but I don't feel as if I'm that much closer. And I think the closest I got was when I asked the woman who'd been playing tennis with her at the time she died. I asked this woman to take me back to the actual place where my mother had collapsed. And this woman left me alone there for a few moments, you know, and I sort of, and oddly enough, it wasn't a tennis court anymore. It's now a car park. It's as if the white lines have been rearranged. You know, there's something logical about that. But I kneeled down sort of behind at the back of a car in the very spot where she'd collapsed, and I sort of put my hand on the ground. And for a moment, I could feel her. I felt I could feel an Airtex shirt, those kind of shirts that people used to play tennis in, and I could feel the warmth of her body underneath almost. And I think that was probably as close as I've got.